This December, it will have been 9 years since the shooting at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, took the lives of 20 first graders and 6 staff. In that time, the name of the school, Sandy Hook, has become synonymous with both tragedy and conspiracy, especially as pushed by one man, Alex Jones, of InfoWars. Despite losing multiple court cases, Jones remains unapologetic about his role in pushing lies and the consequences they lead to. You're listening to And Another Thing from New England Public Media. Derek Kennedy is off today. I'm Maya Schwader. Yesterday, Jones lost yet another defamation suit in Connecticut brought by 8 families of Sandy Hook victims. He previously lost 2 other suits in Texas. The New York Times first reported that Jones, quote, lost by default for refusing to turn over documents that the courts ordered, including financial records. A jury will now decide how much Jones must pay by early next year. How much they must pay by next year. Despite being banned on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook, Jones's radio show still reached more than 3 million people as of February 2020. That's according to the web analytics firm Quantcast and the Anti-Defamation League. The families in this case allege Jones was able to profit off of the conspiracy theories and lies he spread on his huge platform about the circumstances surrounding the shooting. Jones disputes this, but according to Judge Barbara Bellis of Connecticut Superior Court, Jones's legal team failed to back up that claim.
Their failure to produce critical documents, their disregard for the discovery process and procedure and for court orders is a pattern of obstructive conduct that interferes with the ability of the plaintiff to conduct meaningful discovery and prevents the plaintiffs from properly prosecuting their claims.
We reached out to Chris Mattai, the lawyer representing the 8 families in this case. Speaking to Connecticut Public Media, Mattai said of Jones,
he fabricated evidence, he falsely withheld evidence, and as a result of that, the judge concluded that the unusual remedy of default was the only just outcome here.
And Mr. Jones himself framed this as a fight over free speech. On his InfoWars show yesterday, he said,
tyranny is now truly here in America.
We reached out to the lawyers who represented Mr. Jones. They did not respond to a request for comment. We also reached out to some of the families who were suing Jones. Leonard Posner, the father of Noah Posner, responded with a statement. Posner was involved in one of the previous defamation suits against Jones in Texas, and he said he couldn't comment live because of the ongoing nature of the case. But his statement reads in part, quote, the toll of being the canary in the coal mine, warning people that facts can be negated if hoaxers like Jones can just get enough people to repeat them, has been heavy. My family still lives in hiding. We are still the focus of harassment, stalking, doxing, and other online abuse. But I knew that unless hoaxers were exposed as what they were, modern-day snake oil salesmen generating millions of dollars by preying on those of us who are suffering in the wake of unspeakable tragedy, my son's very existence and the existence of all the victims would be debated and minimalized. I knew that I had to stand up to Jones and his ilk, and I am glad that other families followed my lead, ultimately filing their own cases against Jones. That's a statement from Leonard Posner, father of the youngest victim of the Sandy Hook shooting, Noah Posner. In July of 2019, the Connecticut Supreme Court agreed to hear an appeal from Alex Jones to get sanctions on him lifted. His lawyer argued they were threatening his First Amendment rights. Then in March of 2021, Jones tried to have another defamation suit against him dismissed, claiming the defense free speech. So, free speech, First Amendment, is this a legitimate defense in these cases? Well, the courts at the time didn't seem to think so, but why? We spoke with Professor Leslie Levin of the University of Connecticut School of Law about the First Amendment implications of this suit. Quick note, you'll hear Professor Levin reference 2 other lawsuits, Sherlock v. Jones and Lafferty v. Jones. Both of these suits, which also involved Alex Jones, dealt with defamation and whether that speech was protected. We started by asking Professor Levin what effect it has when a popular figure like Alex Jones flouts the rules of the court and refuses to comply with orders like turning over documents.
I think for Alex Jones, it actually is a cautionary tale because he will ultimately be found responsible for what he did and have damages assessed against him. I think that sends a message that you can't ignore discovery requests with impunity. And so that is going to be a useful message.
So the lawyer representing the families in this case has previously said to the media, Mr. Jones, I'm quoting here, Mr. Jones is very used to saying whatever he wants to say from the comfort of his own studio. But what I think this case has shown is that when he is forced to defend his conduct in the court of law and comply with court orders, that's a very different ball game. You mentioned previously that this is a cautionary tale. Can you expand on that a little bit? What kind of different ball game is this?
Well, it's different because what was I think has been shown in this case is you can't just make claims that have no foundation, that are really extraordinarily hurtful, and not pay for that. You know, we're also seeing that there have been lawsuits, for example, that have been brought by Dominion and Smartmatic in connection with the 2020 presidential elections and the statements that were made about those companies that don't seem to have any basis in truth either. And that is getting attention. And I think that we are seeing some companies respond to that by attempting to be somewhat more cautious about what gets said when there's not apparent foundation for the statements.
Previously, Jones has tried to have a lawsuit dismissed on free speech grounds, albeit mm-hmm. with little success. He's also previously claimed that his monologues are protected by the First Amendment, even as he later came out and admits that he was wrong. This is a very philosophical question, but is his speech protected?
No. Actually, it's not a philosophical question. It's a legal question. His speech, in certain respects, is not protected by the First Amendment. And, you know, and that's part of what the Sherlock and Lafferty cases in Connecticut were about. You can't defame people. You can't make statements that put them in a false light. There's a limit to what you can say that exposes people to emotional distress. And while there's constitutional protections for a lot of speech, there's also limits on what you can do. And he really went far beyond the limits.
This seems to, however, be an argument that a lot of people of his ilk like to fall back on, the idea that their speech is protected and they're allowed to say whatever it is they want. There seems to, however, be a disconnect between that and what you just described. Where do you think that disconnect comes from?
I think it comes perhaps from the language of the First Amendment itself, which suggests that there are no limits on speech. But in fact, the way the courts have interpreted the First Amendment, there are quite definitely limits on speech, including defamation, which existed at the time of ratification of the Constitution, and nobody, or the First Amendment, I should say, and nobody suggested at the time that defamation was supposed to be excluded. I mean, there's all kinds of protections for even defamatory speech, and it's very hard to prove. But I think that in Alex Jones's case, it was going to be not difficult to prove that he made his statements in a way that were defamatory and that damages could be obtained as a result of it.
For other people out there who might either espouse Alex Jones's ideas or even imitate him on the internet, do you think this will turn him into a martyr or, as you indicated earlier, perhaps be a lesson for them?
It might turn him into a martyr for some of his followers, but I think it's a lesson for corporations that broadcast speech and or publish speech in any way, that they have to be careful about what gets said. You know, and I think we are seeing that in terms of Fox's responses to the Dominion and Smartmatic litigation. So I do think that some people are getting the message, and yes, others will think that he's a martyr.
Professor Leslie Levin of the University of Connecticut, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. Derek Kennedy is off today. I'm Maya Schwader. Today, we're discussing the defamation suits against InfoWars host Alex Jones, who has spread the conspiracy that the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012 was a hoax. Now, in 2019, under oath, Alex Jones admitted that his opinion was wrong and retracted these statements. However, in order for Jones's conspiracy theories to have the impact that they did, people had to listen and take him seriously, no matter how out there the story he spun was. Joining us now live to dig into how and why people cling to these narratives about Sandy Hook is Amanda J. Crawford. She is a professor of journalism at the University of Connecticut, and she focuses her research on the world of misinformation, especially surrounding the Sandy Hook shooting. Professor Crawford, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start at the very beginning. Where did these conspiracy theories even come from?
You know, they started right away. Jones, on the day of the shooting, was just speculating that we weren't being told the truth about it. It's just pushing out some skepticism about the official narratives. And then we quickly saw the speculation turning into these outrageous theories across social media and stoked certainly by Jones on his program. Some of my research looks at what people use to convince others, and a lot of that quote-unquote evidence was just mistakes that mainstream media reporters made in covering the shooting. They reported the wrong kind of gun, the wrong shooter. And so when those mistakes were corrected by law enforcement, sometimes days later, it showed a discrepancy. And that discrepancy was used to promote what is really a political agenda of denying the shooting because of opposition to any kind of gun reform.
So even after presumably the media made corrections to their stories, people kept clinging to these inconsistencies and using them as evidence, correct? Why is that?
Well, for one reason, it's because the people who are promoting these conspiracy theories don't trust the mainstream media. That's why they're turning to Alex Jones in the first place, right? Believers are turning to Alex Jones because they don't trust the government and institutions and media. And in fact, 2012, the year of the shooting, was at that point a modern low in trust of the mainstream media. And so they don't believe the media's, you know, corrections when they're saying they made a mistake. Instead, they see a vast conspiracy between a media they don't trust and a government they don't trust.
Part of the allegations against Jones, especially in these defamation suits, is that he profited off of telling these lies. So is that all that's in it for Alex Jones? Is this alleged profit?
Well, I mean, he's profiting off of all of the lies he tells on his program, right? I mean, he's made millions off of, an entire career of promoting outrageous lies and conspiracy theories about a whole bunch of different things. But certainly it also promotes and pushes the political agenda here. The people, you know, Jones is opposed to gun reform. He is, a right wing in his belief, even if it's extreme and outrageous. And so there's political motivations, too, you know, at least for Jones. But I think, you know, for him especially, it's probably money, right?
We should note that his claims have lost him audience and sponsors as a result of what he broadcasts. I'm curious, Professor, how does this affect policy when you have these strains of people who just refuse to believe the quote-unquote mainstream narrative?
Well, you know, statistics, you know, studies have shown that about a fourth of people surveyed doubt the, you know, have skepticism about Sandy Hook. We saw studies as early as 6 months after the shooting with a fourth of Americans saying they thought the things were being hidden. And so when you have that, that's a significant minority, and it can be a significantly loud minority, and that's going to affect our debate over gun policy and other things, other kinds of, public policy issues. And we know now that we have, a couple members of Congress who have held these beliefs, who have actively denied that mass shootings ever happened. And that is, you know, they might not always say that on the floor, and it might not always be a point they're making publicly when they oppose a bill, but if they're holding those kind of beliefs, and their belief, you know, their constituents are too, that's going to have an impact on public policy.
Amanda J. Crawford is a professor of journalism at the University of Connecticut. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
While the parents of the Sandy Hook victims continue to fight for justice, foster parents in Massachusetts are facing their own uphill battle. When the state of Massachusetts takes children away from their parents because of alleged neglect or abuse, they are supposed to try to keep siblings together. But some foster parents and advocates say, in reality, they often fail to do so, and they're looking for stronger legal oversight. Here's New England Public Media's Karen Brown.
Snack time at the Cheshire, Massachusetts home of Missy and Dave Targic is bustling, to say the least.
Can I have about a fruit?
The Targics have been taking in foster children for years. At the moment, 6 kids live here, and they're all treated as one family. 3 of them are biological siblings. They have the same mother, but it wasn't easy to keep them together. The oldest sibling, Devon, came to the Targics in 2015 at the age of 4. He's 11 now. Missy Targic, herself a social worker, says Devon's mother was a teenager with substance abuse problems who lost her parental rights.
5 or 6 months in, we just fell in love and we said, you know, we would like to be the pre-adoptive home for Devon.
A few years later, the same mother gave birth to a boy named Jay, and eventually the Targics became Jay's guardians.
It was really a connection for Devon because he didn't have biological family connections. Jay was kind of, you know, it was the first kind of bio family connection he'd had in several years.
Then a girl was born to the same mother, and the Targics became her guardians, too.
Hi, Nyla. You gotta go outside with Daddy, okay?
Devon says he loves being with his siblings.
It feels happy to have my brothers and sisters live with me.
Yeah, what do you like about it?
Everything.
It's almost like you can't really describe kind of already a bond that's there. Almost instantaneously, there's certain mannerisms that are the same. And I know if I'm seeing that they are feeling it and seeing it too.
But then their mother had 2 more children. And Targic says the State Department of Children and Families, or DCF, started to balk at the number of children in the house. The Targics, who have 8 bedrooms, asked for permission to take all the kids.
The biological parents, their attorneys, both the children's attorney, and then we had an attorney, all agreed that they should be placed with us.
But according to Targic and court documents, DCF instead sent them to live with cousins of the biological mom, a couple in Maryland. The Targics have filed a legal motion to reverse that decision. But even if they lose, Missy hopes to draw attention to the value of keeping siblings together. Clinical studies have shown it improves mental health and other outcomes.
It definitely helps, you know, to heal some of that trauma and loss that you've experienced.
That's why Targic and a group she's with called the Massachusetts Alliance for Families is supporting a bill that would require DCF to keep siblings together when possible and make it easier for the courts to intervene when that doesn't happen. State Representative Joan Moschino is the sponsor.
Just by ensuring that the siblings are not separated simply because of administrative convenience, it's really meant to minimize the number of separations that occur, but it acknowledges that sometimes that they do.
As it stands now, social workers often don't even look for siblings when a new child is taken from their parent, according to Kelly Lamb, vice president of the Massachusetts Alliance for Families.
And we hear a lot of times that foster parents are not aware of those children until much later on, and they tend to get very upset, like, why wasn't I the first phone call?
2 of Lamb's children, adopted from foster care, are half-siblings. But she has another adopted child who lives apart from her biological siblings. The Lambs learned accidentally that her mother gave birth to a younger brother, but social workers sent that child to a foster family out of state.
We were never given an answer as to why. And that was really frustrating.
A DCF spokesperson declined to provide an interview and sent a statement instead, saying sibling connections are prioritized, but many factors are considered regarding the child's best interest. In a 2020 report, the agency claimed that in more than 3/4 of cases that year, a minimum of 2 siblings were placed together in foster care. To Andrew Cohen, that's not good enough. He's a lawyer with the Committee for Public Counsel Services, which represents parents and children in the foster care system.
They have been complaining consistently. DCF has not been prioritizing sibling contacts and sibling placement. So this is a huge problem in our Massachusetts foster care system.
The state does have a sibling bill of rights, which says they should be kept together whenever possible, but it's non-binding.
I think most social workers and supervisors do try very hard to place kids together. And kids do come into care very quickly. And so they're making phone calls very quickly to foster homes to see who has space. But the problem is they don't have enough foster homes. They have not been aggressively recruiting.
Who's going to get it? You got it.
As much as their playful family seems like any other, the Targics acknowledge their case is complicated with competing priorities for the foster care system. For one, Missy and Dave are white, and the group of sibling children are Black. According to court documents, the out-of-state relatives where DCF placed the younger siblings are also Black. Again, DCF declined to comment on their decision, but said placing children with relatives is a priority. While Missy Targic says she supports placing children with similar ethnic and racial backgrounds in principle.
I think we have to look at it as the whole picture. The only way that all five children could be together would be in our home. There isn't the option of having all five kids in an African-American family. It's not on the table.
Vanessa Morales agrees there are trade-offs. She's a Black foster mom who works for the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children.
I think they should seek out people who look more like them. I truly believe that. But at the same time, I don't think that they should stop and only look for people of color.
Morales also acknowledges there may be practical reasons to keep siblings apart, like the size of a foster parent's house. And in some cases, if siblings have already gotten close to separate families over time, it may be counterproductive to move them back together.
Each case has a different dynamic, a different tone, a different situation. So I know all cases are different, but at the same time, siblings trump. They should try to keep the siblings together if they can.
The sibling legislation is in committee. Similar bills have failed before. And this version would not necessarily help foster parents like the Targics because, according to Representative Moschino, it's designed for siblings who have lived together, not for those who are biologically related but have never met. Kelly Lamb says that's unfortunate.
I mean, we live in a society that emphasizes our biological connections, right? And many kids who are adopted feel different because they have lost that genetic identity. And the siblings represent that genetic identity, and they did nothing wrong. They did nothing to deserve the separation from each other.
Still, Lamb considers the legislation a good start, since it will give judges more power to override decisions made by DCF to separate siblings.
I just gave it to Sadie, honey. Leo.
The Targics are still waiting for a judge to hear their appeal on the two siblings sent out of state. Meanwhile, they try to have weekly FaceTime calls among the children, but they know the longer they live apart, the less they will feel like brothers and sisters. For New England Public Media, I'm Karen Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us today on And Another Thing. Remember, you can follow us on social media. We are at AAT on NEPM across all platforms. Or you can email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org. I'm Maya Schwader. Have a great evening.